Chapter 52. I knew from the map roughly where the Blackwood was. I found Jameson on the outskirts, standing eerily still, like he couldn't move. Without warning, he broke that stillness, punching furiously at a nearby tree hard and fast, the bark tearing at his hands. Thea brought up Emily. This is what even the mention of her name does to him. Jameson. I was almost to him now. He jerked his head toward me, and I stopped, overwhelmed with the feeling like I shouldn't have been there, that I had no right to witness any of the Hawthorne boys hurting that much. The only thing I could think to do was try to make what I'd just seen matter less. "Broken any fingers lately?" I asked lightly. The pretending it doesn't matter game. Jameson was ready and willing to play. He held his hands up, grunting as he bent them at the knuckles. Still intact. I dragged my eyes from him and took in our surroundings. The perimeter was so densely wooded that if the trees hadn't already shed their leaves, no light would have been able to make it to the forest floor. "What are we looking for?" I asked. Maybe he didn't consider me a real partner in this hunt. Maybe there was no real we, but he answered. "Your guess is as good as mine, Eris." All around us, bare branches stretched up overhead, skeletal and crooked. "You skipped school today to do something," I pointed out. "You have a guess." Jameson smiled like he couldn't feel the blood welling up on his hands. "Four middle names, four locations, four clues. Carvings, most likely. Symbols, if the clue on the bridge was infinity. Numbers, if it was an eight." I wondered what, if anything, he'd done to clear his mind between last night and entering the Blackwood. Climbing, racing, jumping, disappearing into walls. "Do you know how many trees 4 acres can hold, Eris?" Jameson asked jauntily. 200 in a healthy forest. "And in the Blackwood?" I prompted, taking first one step toward him, then another. "At least twice that." It was like the library all over again, like the keys. There had to be a shortcut, a trick we weren't seeing. "Here." Jameson bent down, then placed a roll of the glow-in-the-dark duct tape in my hand, letting his fingers brush mine as he did. "I've been marking off trees as I checked them." I concentrated on his words, not his touch. Mostly. "There's gotta be a better way," I said, turning the duct tape over in my hands, my eyes finding their way to his once more. Jameson's lips twisted into a lazy devil-may-care smirk. "Got any suggestions, mystery girl?" 2 days later, Jameson and I were still doing things the hard way, and we still hadn't found anything. I could see him becoming more and more single-minded. Jameson Winchester Hawthorne would push until he hit a wall. I wasn't sure what he would do to break through it this time, but every once in a while I caught him looking at me in a way that made me think he had some ideas. That was how he was looking at me now. "We aren't the only ones searching for the next clue," he said, as the dusk began to give way to darkness. I saw Grayson with a map of the woods. "Thea's tailing me," I said, ripping off a piece of tape, hyper-aware of the silence all around us. "The only way I can shake her is when she sees an opportunity to mess with Xander." Jameson brushed gently past me and marked off the next tree over. "Thea holds a grudge, and when she and Xander broke up, it was ugly." "They dated?" I slid past Jameson and searched the next tree, running my fingers over the bark. "Thea is practically your cousin." "Constantine is Zara's second husband. The marriage is recent, and Xander's always been a fan of loopholes." Nothing with the Hawthorne brothers was ever simple, including what Jameson and I were doing now. Since we'd worked our way up to the center of the forest, the trees were spread farther apart. Up ahead, I could see a large open space, the only place in the Blackwood where grass was able to grow on the forest floor. My back to Jameson, I moved to a new tree and began running my hands over the bark. Almost immediately, my fingers hit a groove. "Jameson." It wasn't pitch dark yet, but there was little enough light in the woods that I couldn't entirely make out what I'd found, until Jameson appeared beside me, shining an extra light. I ran my fingers slowly over the letters carved into the tree. Tobias Hawthorne II. Unlike the first symbol we'd found, these letters weren't smooth. The carving hadn't been done with an even hand. The name looked like it had been carved by a child. "The eyes at the end are Roman numeral," Jameson said, his voice going electric. "Tobias Hawthorne II. Toby," I thought, and then I heard a crack. A deafening echo followed, and the world exploded, bark flying, my body thrown backward. "Get down," Jameson yelled. I barely heard him. My brain couldn't process what I was hearing, what had just happened. I'm bleeding. Pain. Jameson grabbed me and pulled me toward the ground. The next thing I knew, his body was over mine, and the sound of a second gunshot rang out. Gun! Someone's shooting at us! There was a stabbing pain in my chest. I've been shot! I heard footsteps beating against the forest floor, and then Oren yelled, "Stay down!" Weapon drawn, my bodyguard put himself between us and the shooter. A small eternity passed. Oren took off running in the direction the shots had come from, but I knew, with a prescience I couldn't explain, that the shooter was gone. "Are you okay, Avery?" Oren doubled back. "Jameson, is she okay?" "She's bleeding." That was Jameson. He'd pulled back from my body and was looking down at me. My chest throbbed, just below my collarbone where I'd been hit. "Your face." Jameson's touch was light against my skin. The moment his fingers skimmed lightly over my cheekbone, the nerves in my face were jarred alive. "Hurts." "Did they shoot me twice?" I asked, dazed. "The assailant didn't shoot you at all." Oren made quick work of displacing Jameson and ran his hands expertly over my body, checking for damage. He got hit by a couple pieces of bark. He probed at the wound below my collarbone. The other cut's just a scratch, but the bark's lodged deep in this one. We'll leave it until we're ready to stitch you up. My ears rang. Stitch me up? I didn't want to just repeat what he was saying back to him, but it was literally all my mouth would do. "You're lucky," Oren stood, then did a quick check of the tree where the bullet had hit. "A couple of inches to the right, and we'd be looking at removing a bullet, not bark." My bodyguard stalked past the place where the tree had been hit to another tree behind us. In one smooth motion, he produced a knife from his belt and jammed it into the tree. It took me a moment to realize he was digging out a bullet. "Whoever fired this is long gone now," he said, wrapping the bullet in what appeared to be some kind of handkerchief. "But we might be able to trace this." This, as in a bullet. Someone had just tried to shoot us. Me. My brain was fully catching up now. They weren't aiming for Jameson. What happened here? For once, Jameson didn't sound like he was playing. He sounded like his heart was beating as rapidly and viciously as mine. "What happened," Oren replied, glancing back into the distance, "is that someone saw the two of you out here, decided you were easy targets, and pulled their trigger. Twice." Chapter 53. Someone shot at me. I felt... numb wasn't the right word. My mouth felt too dry. My heart was beating too fast. I hurt, but it felt like I was hurting from a distance. Shock. "I need a team in the northeast quadrant." Oren was on the phone. I tried to focus on what he was saying, but couldn't seem to focus on anything. Not even my arm. "We have a shooter. Gone now, almost certainly, but we'll sweep the woods just in case. Bring a med kit." Oren hung up, then turned his attention back to Jameson and me. "Follow me. We'll stay where we have cover until the support team gets here." He led us back toward the south end of the forest, where the trees were denser. It didn't take the team long to arrive. They came in ATVs, two of them. Two men, two vehicles. As soon as they pulled up, Oren rattled off coordinates, where we'd been when we were shot, the direction the bullets had come from, the trajectory. The men didn't say anything in response. They drew their weapons. Oren climbed into the four-seat ATV and waited for Jameson and me to do the same. "You headed back to the house?" one of the men asked. Oren met his subordinate's eyes. "The cottage." Halfway to Wayback Cottage, my brain started working again. My chest hurt. I'd been given a compress to hold onto the wound, but Oren hadn't treated it yet. His first priority had been getting us to safer ground. He's taking us to Wayback Cottage, not Hawthorne House. The cottage was closer, but I couldn't shake the feeling that what Oren had really been saying to his men was that he didn't trust the people at the house. So much for the way he'd assured me, repeatedly, that I was safe. That the Hawthorne family wasn't a threat. The entire estate, including the Blackwood, was walled in. No one was allowed past the gate without a thorough background check. Oren doesn't think we're dealing with an outside threat. I let that sink in, a heaviness in my stomach as I processed the limited number of suspects. The Hawthorns and the staff. Going to Wayback Cottage felt like a risk. I hadn't interacted with the Laughlins much, but they hadn't ever given me the impression that they were glad I was here. Exactly how loyal are they to the Hawthorne family? I thought about Elisa saying that Nash's people would die for him. Would they kill for him, too? Mrs. Laughlin was at home when we arrived at Wayback. She's not the shooter, I thought. She couldn't have made it back here in time, could she? The older woman took one look at Oren, Jameson, and me and ushered us inside. If a bleeding person being stitched up at her kitchen table was an unusual occurrence, she gave no sign of it. I wasn't sure if the way she was taking this in stride was comforting or suspicious. "I'll put on some tea," she said, my heart pounding. I wondered if it was safe to drink anything she gave me. "You okay with me playing medic?" Oren asked, settling me into a chair. "I'm sure Lisa could arrange for some fancy plastic surgeon." I wasn't okay with any of this. Everyone had been so sure that I wasn't going to get axe murdered that I'd let my guard down. I'd pushed back the thought that people had killed over far less than what I'd inherited. I'd let every single one of the Hawthorne brothers pass my defenses. This wasn't Xander. I couldn't get my body to calm down, no matter how hard I tried. Jameson was right next to me. Nash doesn't want the money, and Grayson wouldn't... he wouldn't. "Avery?" Oren prompted, a note of concern working its way into his deep voice. I tried to stop my mind from racing. I felt sick, physically sick. "Stop panicking." I had a piece of wood in my flesh. I would have preferred not to have a piece of wood in my flesh. "Pull it together." "Do what you need to do to stop the bleeding," I told Oren. My voice only shook a little. Removing the bark hurt. The disinfectant hurt a hell of a lot more. The med kit included a shot of local anesthetic, but there was no amount of anesthetic that could alter my brain's awareness of the needle when Oren began stitching my skin back together. "Focus on that. Let it hurt." After a moment, I looked away from Oren and tracked Mrs. Laughlin's movements. Before handing me my tea, she laced it, heavily, with whiskey. "Done." Oren nodded to my cup. "Drink that." He'd brought me here because he trusted the Laughlins more than he trusted the Hawthorns. He was telling me that it was safe to drink. But he'd told me a lot of things. Someone shot at me. They tried to kill me. I could be dead. My hands were shaking. Oren steadied them. His eyes knowing, he lifted my teacup to his own mouth and took a drink. "It's fine. He's showing me that it's fine." Unsure if I'd ever be able to kick myself out of fight-or-flight mode, I forced myself to drink. The tea was hot. The whiskey was strong. It burned all the way down. Mrs. Laughlin gave me an almost maternal look, then scowled at Oren. "Mr. Laughlin will want to know what happened," she said, as if she herself were not at all curious about why I was bleeding at her kitchen table. "And someone needs to clean up the poor girl's face." She gave me a sympathetic look and clucked her tongue. Before, I'd been an outsider. Now she was hovering like a mother hen. All it took were a few bullets. "Where is Mr. Laughlin?" Oren asked, his tone conversational, but I heard the question and the implication underneath. "He's not here. Is he a good shot? Would he—" As if summoned, Mr. Laughlin walked through the front door and let it slam behind him. There was mud on his boots. "From the woods?" "Something's happened," Mrs. Laughlin told her husband calmly. Mr. Laughlin looked at Oren, Jameson, and me, in that order, the same order in which his wife had taken in our presence, and then poured himself a glass of whiskey. "Security protocols?" he asked Oren gruffly. Oren gave a brisk nod, in full force. He turned back to his wife. "Where's Rebecca?" he asked. Jameson looked up from his own cup of tea. "Rebecca's here?" "She's a good girl," Mr. Laughlin grunted. "Comes to visit, the way she should." "So where is she?" I thought. Mrs. Laughlin rested a hand on my shoulder. "There's a bathroom through there, dear," she told me quietly, "if you want to clean up." Chapter 54. The door Mrs. Laughlin had sent me through didn't lead directly to a bathroom. It led to a bedroom that held two twin beds and little else. The walls were painted a light purple, and the twin comforters were quilted from squares of fabric in lavender and violet. The bathroom door was slightly ajar. I walked toward it, so painfully aware of my surroundings that I felt like I could have heard a pin drop a mile away. "There's no one here. I'm safe. I'm okay. I'm okay." Inside the bathroom, I checked behind the shower curtain. "There's no one here," I told myself. "I'm okay." I managed to get my cell phone out of my pocket and called Max. I needed her to answer. I needed not to be alone with this. What I got was voicemail. I called 7 times and she didn't pick up. Maybe she couldn't. Or maybe she doesn't want to. That hit me almost as hard as looking in the mirror and seeing my blood-streaked, dirt-smeared face. I stared at myself. I could hear the echo of gunfire. Stop. I needed to wash. My hands, my face, the streaks of blood on my chest. Turn on the water, I told myself sternly. Pick up the washcloth. I willed my body to move. I couldn't. Hands reached past me to turn on the faucet. I should have jumped. I should have panicked. But somehow my body relaxed into the person behind me. "It's okay, Eris," Jameson murmured. "I've got you." I hadn't heard Jameson come in. I wasn't entirely sure how long I'd been standing there, frozen. Jameson reached for a pale purple washcloth and held it under the water. "I'm fine," I insisted, as much to myself as to him. Jameson lifted the washcloth to my face. "You're a horrible liar." He ran the cloth over my cheek, working his way down toward the scratch. A breath caught it in my throat. He rinsed the washcloth, blood and dirt coloring the sink, as he lifted the cloth back to my skin. Again and again. He washed my face, took my hands in his, and held them under the water, his fingers working the dirt from mine. My skin responded to his touch. For the first time, no part of me said to pull away. He was so gentle. He wasn't acting like this was just a game to him, like I was just a game. He picked the washcloth back up and ran it down my neck to my shoulder, over my collarbone and across. The water was warm. I leaned into his touch. This is a bad idea. I knew that. I'd always known that, but I'd let myself concentrate on the feel of Jameson Hawthorne's touch, the stroke of the cloth. "I'm okay," I said, and I could almost believe that. "You're better than okay." I closed my eyes. He'd been there with me in the forest. I could feel his body over mine, protecting me. I needed this. I needed something. I opened my eyes, looked at him, focused on him. I thought about going 200 miles an hour, about the climbing wall, about the moment I'd first seen him on that balcony. Was being a sensation seeker so bad? Was wanting to feel something other than awful really so wrong? Everyone is a little wrong sometimes, Eris. Something gave inside of me, and I pushed him gently back against the bathroom wall. I need this. His deep green eyes met mine. He needs it too. "Yes?" I asked him hoarsely. "Yes, Eris." My lips closed over his. He kissed me back, gentle at first, then not gently at all. Maybe it was the after effects of shock, but as I drove my hands into his hair, as he grabbed my ponytail and angled my face upward, I could see 1,000 versions of him in my mind, balanced on the balcony's railing, shirtless and sunlit in the solarium, smiling, smirking, our hands touching on the bridge, his body protecting mine in the blackwood, trailing a washcloth down my neck. Kissing him felt like fire. He wasn't soft and sweet the way he had been when washing away the blood and dirt. I didn't need soft or sweet. This was exactly what I needed. Maybe I could be what he needed, too. Maybe this didn't have to be a bad idea. Maybe the complications were worth it. He pulled back from the kiss, his lips only an inch away from mine. "I always knew you were special." I felt his breath on my face. I felt every last one of those words. I'd never thought of myself as special. I'd been invisible for so long. Wallpaper. Even after I'd become the biggest story in the world, it had never really felt like anyone was paying attention to me. The real me. "We're so close now," Jameson murmured. "I can feel it." There was an energy in his voice, like the buzzing of a neon light. Someone obviously didn't want us looking at that tree. "What?" He went to kiss me again, and, my heart sinking, I turned my head to the side. I wasn't sure what I'd thought. That when he told me I was special, he wasn't talking about the money, or the puzzle. "You think someone shot at us because of a tree?" I said, the words getting caught in my throat. "Not, say, the fortune I inherited that your family would like to get their hands on? Not the billions of reasons that anyone with the last name Hawthorne has to hate me?" "Don't think about that," Jameson whispered, cupping my cheeks. "Think about Toby's name carved into that tree. Infinity carved into that bridge." His face was close enough to mine that I could still feel his breath. "What if what the puzzle is trying to tell us is that my uncle isn't dead?" Was that what he'd been thinking when someone was shooting at us? In the kitchen, as Oren took a needle to my wound? As he'd brought his lips to mine? Because if the only thing he'd been able to think was about the mystery... "You're not a player, kid. You're the glass ballerina, or the knife." "Will you listen to yourself?" I demanded. My chest was tight, tighter now than it had been in the forest, in the thick of it all. Nothing about Jameson's reaction should have surprised me, so why did it hurt? Why was I letting it hurt? "Oren just pulled a chunk of wood out of my chest," I said. My voice low. and if things had worked out a little differently, he could have been pulling out a bullet. I gave Jameson a second to reply. Just one. Nothing. What happens to the money if I die while the will is in probate? I asked flatly. Elisa had told me the Hawthorne family didn't stand to benefit, but did they know that? What happens if whoever fired that gun scares me off, and I leave before the year is up? Did they know that if I left, it all went to charity? Not everything is a game, Jameson. I saw something flicker in his eyes. He closed them just for an instant, then opened them and leaned in, bringing his lips painfully close to mine. That's the thing, Eris. If Emily taught me anything, it's that everything is a game. Even this. Especially this. Chapter 55. Jameson left and I didn't follow him. Thea's right. Grayson whispered in the recesses of my mind. This family, we destroy everything we touch. I choked back tears. I'd been shot at, I'd been injured, and I'd been kissed. But I sure as hell wasn't destroyed. I'm stronger than that. I angled my face toward the mirror and looked myself in the eye. If it came down to a choice between being scared, being hurt, and being pissed, I knew the one which I preferred. I tried calling Max one more time, then texted her. Someone tried to kill me, and I made out with Jameson Hawthorne. If that didn't garner a response, nothing would. I made my way back into the bedroom. Even though I'd calmed down a little, I still scanned for threats, and I saw one. Rebecca Laughlin standing in the doorway. Her face looked even paler than usual. Her hair as red as blood. She looked shell-shocked. Because she overheard Jameson and me? Because her grandparents told her about the shooting? I wasn't sure. She was wearing thick hiking boots and cargo pants, both of them spattered with mud. Staring at her, all I could think was that if Emily had been even half as beautiful as her sister was, it was no wonder Jameson could look at me and think only about his grandfather's game. Everything is a game. Even this, especially this. My grandmother sent me here to check on you. Rebecca's voice was soft and hesitant. I'm okay, I said, and I almost meant it. I had to be okay. Gran said you were shot. Rebecca stayed in the doorway, like she was afraid to come any closer. Shot at, I clarified. I'm glad, Rebecca said, and then she looked mortified. I mean, that you weren't shot. It's good, right? Getting shot at instead of shot? Her gaze darted nervously from me toward the twin beds, the quilts. Emily would have told you to simplify and say that you were shot. Rebecca sounded more sure of herself telling me what Emily would have said than trying to summon an appropriate response herself. There was a bullet. You were wounded. Emily would have said you were entitled to a little melodrama. I was entitled to look at everyone like they were a suspect. I was entitled to an adrenaline-fueled lapse in judgment. And maybe I was entitled just this once to push for answers. You and Emily shared this room? I said. That was obvious now when I looked at the twin beds. When Rebecca and Emily came to visit their grandparents, they stayed here. Was purple your favorite color as a kid or hers? Hers, Rebecca said. She gave me a very small shrug. She used to tell me that my favorite color was purple too. In the picture I'd seen of the two of them, Emily had been looking directly at the camera, dead center. Rebecca had been the one on the fringes, looking away. I feel like I should warn you. Rebecca wasn't even facing me anymore. She walked over to the one of the beds. Warn me about what? I asked. And somewhere in the back of my mind, I registered the mud on her boots. And the fact that she'd been on the premises, but not with her grandparents, when I'd been shot at. Just because she doesn't feel like a threat doesn't mean she isn't one. But when Rebecca started talking again, it wasn't about the shooting. I'm supposed to say that my sister was wonderful. She acted like that wasn't a change of subject, like Emily was what she was warning me about. And she was, when she wanted to be. Her smile was contagious, her laugh was worse, and when she said something was a good idea, people believed her. She was good to me, almost all the time. Rebecca met my gaze head on. But she wasn't nearly as good to those boys. Boys, plural. What did she do? I asked. I should have been more focused on who shot me, but part of me couldn't shake the way Jameson had invoked Emily right before walking away from me. Em didn't like to choose. Rebecca seemed to be picking her words carefully. She wanted everything more than I wanted anything, and the one time I wanted something, she shook her head and aborted that sentence. My job was to keep my sister happy. It's something my parents used to tell me when we were little. that Emily was sick and I wasn't, so I should do what I could to make her smile. And the boys? I asked. They made her smile. I read into what Rebecca was saying, what she'd been saying. Em didn't like to choose. She dated both of them? I tried to get a handle on that. Did they know? Not at first, Rebecca whispered, like some part of her thought Emily might hear us talking. What happened when Grayson and Jameson found out she was dating both of them? You're only asking that because you didn't know Emily, Rebecca said. She didn't want to choose, and neither one of them wanted to let her go. She turned it into a competition, a little game. And then she died. How did Emily die? I asked. Because I might never get another opening like this one. Not with Rebecca, not with the boys. Rebecca was looking at me, but I got the general sense that she wasn't seeing me, that she was somewhere else. Grayson told me that it was her heart, she whispered. Grayson. I couldn't think beyond that. It wasn't until Rebecca had left that I realized she'd never gotten around to telling me what, specifically, she ought to have been warning me about. Chapter 56. It was another 3 hours before Oren and his team cleared me to go back to Hawthorne House. I rode back in the ATV with 3 bodyguards. Oren was the only one who spoke. Due in part to Hawthorne House's extensive network of security cameras, my team was able to track and verify locations and alibis for all members of the Hawthorne family, as well as Miss Thea Caligaris. They have alibis. Grayson has an alibi. I felt a rush of relief, but a moment later my chest tightened. What about Constantine? I asked. Technically, he wasn't a Hawthorne. Clear, Oren told me. He did not personally wield that gun. Personally. Reading behind those lines shook me. But he might have hired someone? Any of them might have, I realized. I could hear Grayson telling me that there would always be people tripping over themselves to do favors for his family. I know a forensic investigator, Oren said evenly. He works alongside an equally skilled hacker. They'll take a deep dive into everyone's finances and cell phone records. In the meantime, my team is going to focus on the staff. I swallowed. I hadn't even met most of the staff. I didn't know exactly how many of them there were, or who might have had an opportunity, or motive. The entire staff? I asked Oren, including the Laughlins? They had been kind to me after I'd emerged from washing up, but right now I couldn't afford to trust my gut, or Oren's. They're clear, Oren told me. Mr. Laughlin was at the house during the shooting, and security footage confirms Mrs. Laughlin was at the cottage. What about Rebecca? I asked. She'd left the estate right after talking to me. I could see Oren wanting to say Rebecca wasn't a threat, but he didn't. No stone will be left unturned, he promised. But I do know that the Laughlin girls never learned to shoot. Mr. Laughlin wasn't even allowed to keep a gun at the cottage when they were present. Who else was on the premises today? I asked. Pool maintenance, a sound technician working on upgrades in the theater, a massage therapist, and one of the cleaning staff. I committed that list to memory. Then my mouth went dry. Which cleaning staff? Melissa Vincent. That name meant nothing to me, until it did. Melly? Oren's eyes narrowed. You know her? I thought of the moment she'd seen Nash outside of Libby's room. Something I should know? Oren asked. And it wasn't really a question. I told him what Elisa had said about Melly and Nash, what I'd seen in Libby's room, what Melly had seen. And then we pulled up to Hawthorne House, and I saw Elisa. She's the only person I've let past the gates, Oren assured me. Frankly, she's the only one I intend to let pass those gates for the foreseeable future. I probably should have found that more comforting than I did. How is she? Elisa asked Oren as soon as we exited the SUV. Pissed, I answered, before Oren could reply on my behalf. Sore, a little terrified. Seeing her and seeing Oren standing next to her broke the dam, and an accusation burst out of me. You both told me I would be fine. You swore that I was not in danger. You acted like I was being ridiculous when I mentioned murder. Technically, my lawyer replied, you specified axe murder. And technically, she continued through gritted teeth, it is possible that there was an oversight, legally speaking. What kind of oversight? You told me that if I died, the Hawthorns wouldn't get a penny. And I stand by that conclusion, Elisa said emphatically. However, she clearly found an admission of fault distasteful. I also told you that if you died while the will was in probate, your inheritance would pass through to your estate. And typically it would. Typically, I repeated. If there was one thing I'd learned in the past week is that there was nothing typical about Tobias Hawthorne, or his heirs. However, Elisa continued, her voice tight, in the state of Texas, it is possible for the deceased to add a stipulation to the will that requires heirs to survive him by a certain amount of time in order to inherit. I'd read the will multiple times. Pretty sure I'd remember if there was something in there about how long I had to avoid dying to inherit. The only stipulation was that you must live in Hawthorne House for 1 year, Elisa finished, which I will admit would be quite the difficult stipulation to fulfill if you were dead. Then my bodyguard answered the question. I had my people check the armory. Nothing is missing. In all likelihood, the weapon fired at Avery wasn't a Hawthorne gun, but I had my men pull the security footage from the past few days anyway. I was too busy trying to wrap my mind around the fact that Hawthorne House had an armory. That was her oversight? The fact that I couldn't live in Hawthorne House if I wasn't alive? So if I die, I swallowed, wetting my tongue, the money goes to charity? Possibly, but it's also possible that your heirs could challenge that interpretation on the basis of Mr. Hawthorne's intent. I don't have heirs, I said. I don't even have a will. You don't need a will to have heirs. Elisa glanced at Orin. Had her sister been cleared? Libby? I was incredulous. Had they met my sister? The sister's clear, Orin told Elisa. She was with Nash during the shooting. He might as well have detonated a bomb for how well that went over. Eventually, Elisa gathered her composure and turned back to me. You won't legally be able to sign a will until you turn 18. Ditto for the paperwork regarding the Foundation conservatorship. And that is the other oversight here. Originally, I was focused only on the will, but if you are unable or unwilling to fulfill your role as conservator, the conservatorship passes, she paused heavily, to the boys. If I died, the Foundation, all the money, all the power, all that potential, went to Tobias Hawthorne's grandsons, $100 million a year to give away. He could buy a lot of favors for money like that. Who knows about the terms of the Foundation's conservatorship? Orin asked, deadly serious. Zara and Constantine, certainly, Elisa said immediately. Grayson, I added hoarsely, my wounds throbbing. I knew him well enough to know that he would have demanded to see the conservatorship papers himself. He wouldn't hurt me. I wanted to believe that. All he does is warn me away. How soon can you have documents drawn up, leaving control of the Foundation to Avery's sister in the event of her death? Orin demanded. If this was about control of the Foundation, that would protect me, or else it would put Libby in danger too. Is anyone going to ask me what I want to do? I asked. I can have the documents drawn up tomorrow, Elisa told Orin, ignoring me. But Avery can't legally sign them until she's 18, and even then it's unclear if she's authorized to make that kind of decision prior to assuming full control of the Foundation at the age of 21. Until then, I had a target on my forehead. What would it take to evoke the protection clause in the will? Orin changed tactics. There are circumstances under which Avery could remove the Hawthorns as tenants, correct? We'd need evidence, Elisa replied, something that ties a specific individual or individuals to acts of harassment, intimidation, or violence. And even then, Avery can only kick out the perpetrator, not the whole family. And she can't live somewhere else for the time being? No. Orin didn't like that, but he didn't waste time on unnecessary commentary. You'll go nowhere without me, Orin told me, steel in his voice. Not on the estate, not in the house. Nowhere, you understand? I was always close by. Now I get to play visible deterrent. Beside me, Elisa narrowed her eyes at Orin. What do you know that I don't? There was a single moment's pause to process the rest. The armory had a visitor? Elisa asked, her voice almost too calm. Two of them. Orin seemed like he might stop there for my benefit, but he pressed on. Jameson and Grayson. Both have alibis, but both were looking at rifles. Hawthorne House has an armory? That was all I could manage to say. This is Texas, Orin replied. The whole family grew up shooting, and Mr. Hawthorne was a collector. A gun collector, I clarified. I hadn't been a fan of firearms before I'd almost been shot. If you'd read the binder I left you detailing your assets, Elisa interjected, you'd know that Mr. Hawthorne had the world's largest collection of late 19th and early 20th century Winchester rifles, several of which are valued at upward of $400,000. The idea that anyone would pay that much for a rifle was mind-boggling, but I barely batted an eye at the price tag, because I was too busy thinking that there was a reason Jameson and Grayson had both made visits to the armory to look at rifles, one that had nothing to do with shooting me. Jameson's middle name was Winchester.